Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to That'll Be The Day. In this Christmas edition of my podcast, I'm talking to a visually impaired comedian from Liverpool who will cheer you up even in these difficult Omicron times. But before we hear from Chris McCausland, if you like the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be The Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. And as always, I'll be featuring a track by the band at the end of this podcast. To find out which one it is, stay tuned. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a bit funny about comedians. I just think they should make me laugh. Not all of them manage to do that, but one comedian who definitely does is Chris McCausland. Whenever I watch him on the telly or listen to him on the radio, I end up laughing like the proverbial drain. When I spoke to Chris a couple of weeks ago on Zoom, he was in great form. And given the amount of media work he's now doing, I started by asking him, are you famous?
No. I wouldn't say so. No. A couple of people have come up and said hello, but you know, maybe people are silently pointing at me as I walk past. Somebody said hello to me in Nando's once. So that was nice, but no, not really. No.
One of the joys of being visually impaired is that we don't know when people are pointing at us or whatever, do we? And that can be quite a good thing, I think.
Yeah, it can be. But it also means that, you know, have you always been blind, Tom?
I've been visually impaired. Yeah, I was born totally blind. And then at the age of 3 and a half, after a number of operations, sight was restored, if that's the right word, to my right eye, about between 2 and 3%, and I have light perception in my left, so I have a small amount of useful vision.
You've always had next to nothing.
No, I've had next to nothing. I've turned jaws off now on the recording, so flying blind to a certain extent, but with a magnifier, I can see what's happening just about.
When you're losing your sight, because I started off with pretty good sight, and then I lost it very, very gradually. And when you're kind of losing your sight at that rate, there's like a huge chunk, especially when you're in, you know, in that kind of phase of life when you want to be cool, or you know, you're a teenager or whatever, and in your head, when you're trying to blunder your way through life, getting used to not being able to see, everybody's pointing and laughing at you.
I was going to ask you about that actually, Chris, because you and I both went to the same school, albeit you're considerably younger than me. You went to what was then New College, Worcester. And I was going to ask you about that because I'm presuming when you were there, you had a fair degree of sight.
My eyesight was really good compared to most of the kids. So I was, racing around on the bikes and playing football. And I would say one of the best football players in the college, but to say one of the best football players in a blind college, that was the level of my eyesight, if you know what I mean. I think one of the, I don't know what you can put out on this podcast, but one of the kind of metaphors you can use is the best looking guy in the Burns wing. If you know.
What were you like as a young lad at school, Chris? I mean, I spoke to a couple of people who know you or who knew you at school, and they said that you certainly had a sharp wit. Would that be fair?
I think that's a very polite way of saying I was a cheeky pain in the ass, isn't it? I was gobby. Yeah, I was a bit. You know, I was a nuisance back then. It's especially at Worcester, probably because you're away from home as well, aren't you? And I also was, maybe because my eyesight was so good, almost kind of resistant to being like part of a blind school. Do you know what I mean? I always had this kind of defiance in me because you're kind of getting labeled and categorized and as something that you maybe don't see yourself as being. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's huge periods of your life where you go through denial and you know, and as your eyesight's, you know, diminishing more and more and more, you kind of maybe push back against it more, especially when you're young. I was probably what the teachers would call a little shit, but I was a nuisance. If you need a pre-war to shit version of this podcast,
well, people can listen to it whenever they choose. Quite honestly. If they want the post-watershed version, then they may be getting it. I try to be polite, but I entirely understand what you're saying there, Chris. Were you funny at school? Did people find you funny?
Do Do you know what? I mean, I think back to my school reports, and there were a lot of school reports that not only said that I was disruptive in class or a bit of a nuisance, but quite a few of them, I reckon, if you went through them, would say, thinks he's the class clown. Nothing good will ever come of it. So I would like to... I would like to revisit those teachers with those school reports and say, well, you know, whatever you think of what I've been doing on the telly, it's certainly come of something.
Well, that didn't stop you getting to university, though, did it? Because you got to, am I right in saying you went to Kingston University and did software engineering?
When I left St. Vincent's, I went to college in Liverpool. And I mean, it might have just been called Liverpool College or whatever. But I lasted about 6 weeks. And this was back in about 94. And just the support that the college offered was non-existent. It was just a different era. And they were unable to teach me. They were unable to provide the materials to include me in the classes. And I lasted maybe 4 or 6 weeks. And I ended up going to RNC for 2 years. And so my experience of trying my hand at the mainstream further education wasn't really that good, to be honest. And so I wasn't going to go to uni. And it was a guy called Tim Ashmore, who was the maths lecturer at RNC, who probably in terms of teachers, I would say was the most influential person within my education. He was wonderful, but he convinced me to just apply to the universities. And then if I don't want to go, I don't have to go. So to keep him quiet, I applied to 6 of them. And one of them I put down was Kingston, just because a mate of mine had gone there the year before and seemed to be having a good time. So that was the level of my research into, the educational institution that was going to offer me the best prospects. It's just, well, if I went there, I'd know someone and I wouldn't be just on my own in a new place, which I found really intimidating, to be honest.
And how was university for you as a visually impaired person? Did they make the changes, the adaptations that you needed? Because it sounds to me like software engineering is one of those courses that would need quite a lot of adaptation.
Yeah, and Kingston was very good, to be honest. I had such a good first year socially that I'll be honest, I didn't do a lot. And the thing with computers is when you do a degree in software engineering, which is computer science, really, the first year is for people that have never done A-level computers or maths. And I did A-level computers and A-level maths and AS-level further maths. And so I found it so easy that the subjects they were teaching that I didn't really go to a lot and subsequently passed by the skin of my teeth because... The funny thing is I had to have a meeting at the end of the first year with one of the lecturers who was going to decide based on this one meeting whether I got passed to the second year. And I turned up and he was like, oh, I don't even recognize you. He didn't recognize me from any of the classes. And the thing is I didn't, his name was Nigel Ling. And I just assumed with a surname like Ling, it just sounded a little bit Chinese to me. And I thought there was going to be this Chinese fella turning up. And he was this middle-class white English fella who turned up. And that surprised me as well, because I'd never been to his lectures. He'd never seen me.
And then the second and third years, you worked harder, I guess, did you?
Yeah, harder. But I was very much a deadline worker.
From a social point of view, it sounded like you had a really good time at Kingston. Were students quite cool with you, were they? They didn't mind or didn't raise any problems with the fact that you're visually impaired?
No, it was all good. And as I say, I followed a friend of mine down here who did very well in his first year. And then I arrived. And because I had such a good first year, he failed his second year and had to repeat his first year. So he failed his second year and had to repeat that. So we ended up on the second year at the same time.
When you graduated, then you went into programming or software analysis or something along those lines, did you?
I did my placement year doing website development and at a software company. And then when I came out of uni, I was looking for, you know, similar work, really, and applying to lots of things and just not getting anything, really. You know, I went for interviews where the systems that they used were inaccessible.
Because I'm presuming by this point you were definitely needing access software of some description or other.
Yeah, so I kind of transitioned from Zoom Text to, oh yeah, I used JAWS for a while. So I transitioned from Zoom Text to JAWS. But this was around about the time as well that, you know, website design was becoming about making things look very much drag and drop. And as a result, creative development, you know, tools became very much about the visual elements of design as much as the coding in the background. And so I found that I was just not as good as the person sat next to me because of my eyesight. And so by the time I finished uni, I was kind of drifting away from the website design and just wanted a job in IT, really, in other areas of IT. But as you know, the systems that the companies had were just not accessible in a lot of cases. I mean, it was just a completely different world 20 years ago, you know.
Did your visual impairment go against you as well, do you think?
Yeah, and probably my own confidence with it. I wasn't exactly confident with it because I was still losing my sight.
Yeah.
And I found that, I mean, now, like, you look at, people keep on saying to me stories, oh, have you seen this thing that gives you some of your sight back, this new device that you wear that, you know, you can see? I would rather be able to see nothing than a little bit because I find it easier.
Very interesting you should say that. I had a similar conversation with somebody on a different podcast the other day. And yes, I think those of us who have a small amount of sight do sometimes experience more difficulties than those that have nothing.
Yeah, you try and do more things that you just can't do. And I mean, maybe I'm just talking from a point of view of losing it slowly and denial, in that you still think you can do things that you know, it takes an inciting incident or almost killing yourself, almost getting hit by a bus in the dusk to realize that maybe you shouldn't be crossing busy roads anymore and things like that.
You mentioned there, Chris, about confidence. And listening to you now and seeing you on the television, hearing you on the radio, one thing that you aren't short of now is confidence. Where did that come from? Where did that renewed confidence appear from?
Well, I've been doing stand-up for, I'm in my 19th year now, so I've got a lot of confidence in terms of performing. But that confidence doesn't necessarily, you know, transfer into other areas of your life. When I started doing stand-up, I had a job for 2 years when I was doing open mic comedy. And at that point, I could stand up in a room of 50 people and do stand-up, but I couldn't put my hand up in a meeting and ask a question in case it was a stupid question. The confidence that you have in one area doesn't necessarily make you a confident person across the board. I mean, I see people, you know, you get people who are you know, blind, who go out and do all kinds of things with their dog or their stick or whatever, and I don't have that kind of confidence. So in terms of performing, it's confidence I've built up over 19 years. But in terms of TV, it's a confidence that I think I have now because I'm 44, and if I was 34, I think I wouldn't have been as comfortable as myself to have that level of confidence on the telly. I think if I was 34 on the telly, I would have tried to play the part of the kind of TV comedian I thought I wanted to be. I think I'd have tried to be a little bit moody, a little bit kind of deadpan, a little bit cool. And because I'm kind of a lot more comfortable with myself now at the age of 44, I think I'm just enjoying myself. I'm a lot more happy just being me. And as a result, on the telly, you just look like you're having a better time and you look more confident.
Can I take you back to the first open mic night you did in Balham in, was it 2003?
Yeah.
As you prepared for that, you would have been at home, no doubt, and thinking, what am I going to wear and all that sort of stuff. How were you feeling as you approached that open mic night?
I felt sick. Like you could have pushed me over with a finger. I mean, I don't know why I put myself through it, to be honest. It was on a Tuesday night and I took the Monday and the Tuesday off work. It was weighing so heavily on me. And at the time I was a smoker, and I mean, on the Tuesday, I don't think I ate anything. I think I just drank coffee and smoked cigarettes. I couldn't bear the thought of solid food. And when I arrived to do the gig, I felt so sick in my stomach, which is probably because I'd only had nicotine and caffeine. But
yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, I don't know why I put myself through it. It was a real dare to myself because I've always been such a comedy fan. And it was just one of them things that I dwelled on too long that, oh, what a cool job it must be. What a cool thing it must be to do comedy. I could never do that. And then I just kind of thought, you know, I'm sure loads of people must have a go and be rubbish at it.
The first gig obviously went well enough for you to carry on with it then.
Yeah, and yeah. It's a lottery because everyone, you can't avoid bad gigs. And especially on the open mic circuit, because there's so many things against you in terms of the room and the setup and small audiences and so on. But I was lucky that the first gig was nice and the second gig was nice. And by the time I had a horrible, tough gig, I'd done enough of them to realize that I could get a laugh out of an audience. Whereas there's probably loads of people out there that have such an awful first gig that they think, oh, this isn't for me. I'm not going to do this again.
From your point of view as a visually impaired person, were you listening for sort of feedback from the audience? I mean, obviously, if people are laughing or whatever, you know that you're doing okay. Was that how it worked for you then?
The swings and roundabouts in that I can't see the smiling faces in the room. So I do rely on the laughter, but I also can't see the people that hate me.
And you've done a lot of television as well, EastEnders, and I know you've been on CBeebies, Blankety Blank, and many more, Live at the Apollo. The television is a fundamentally visual medium. How do you cope with that as a blind person? Because my big anxiety is, how do I look? I did a bit of telly earlier this year, and the only thing I was worried about was I didn't look gormless. That was the word I used to the production staff. What are your thoughts on that?
When you're doing primetime telly or proper kind of comedy shows and things like that, you don't have to worry about your clothes. You know, you take your clothes, but there's people there to check over them and things like that. You get someone put your makeup on and do your hair because, you know, you don't want a big shiny face on the telly, the lights and all that. So it's not really something that you have to worry about. It's more your lack of awareness of visual things that are going on. What I've realized, or what you've kind of got to realize, is that you can't see things. And it doesn't matter whether you misunderstand something that's happened in the room, because that can just be funny. And if you're relaxed with it, then the audience is relaxed with it. And part of normalizing blindness is allowing people to see that shit happening. you know what I mean? Yeah, and if you're comfortable with it, then everybody's comfortable with it. I'm a believer that people can make tweaks to shows in order to make them a little bit more accessible. But I don't want people changing things too much. You know, when I did Have I Got News For You, it's a very visual show. And we made a few little tweaks to the show to make it a more accessible experience. But yet there were still people on Twitter who said, I can't believe how visual Have I Got News For You was. It's a disgrace. Well, that's Have I Got News For You. And I want to do Have I Got News For You. I don't want to be the person on Have I Got News For You that changes it past the point where it stops being Have I Got News For You.
Mercifully, apparently I didn't look gormless. And I went to my sister afterwards and asked her for her appraisal. And I knew if anybody would be honest, she would say, oh, that was rubbish, or it was good. And mercifully, she was very positive. Do you have somebody who you go to get some evaluation, some feedback on how you've done? Who do you speak to? Who gives you the honest version? Because you know what it's like in the media. Everybody goes, oh, yeah, that was great. That was fine. That was lovely. And it's hard to know whether to take them seriously or not.
Yeah, I mean, my agent is always with me at most recordings, but always good with the feedback. I can't watch myself without bias. And it's not the bias that you would think, going, oh, aren't I great? Look at me. I hate myself so much that I can't. I am my own worst critic. I can't watch myself and see the good in it. I just see the things that I've said wrong or that I should have said differently. And it almost takes somebody else to tell me the good thing.
Yeah. When I do radio, I often listen back, but I listen back purely actually to learn and think, no, that didn't work or that did work. So look, I'm not so self-critical, but I do try and learn from every piece, I guess.
Yeah, well, I remember watching, I did a drama thing, a Jimmy McGovern series, and I remember it, yeah. And I was watching it on the couch with my wife, and every time I came on, I audibly and, you know, physically squirmed. And my wife said, "Oh God, can you just leave the room? I can't sit here and pretend that isn't you when you're sat here next to me, reminding me it is you every time you come on the screen." One thing I can't do is I can't watch it while it's on the telly. So, for example, when Blankety Blank was on, I couldn't sit at home and watch Blankety Blank when it's on, knowing that millions of people are watching it at the same time. That just makes me far more squirmish than usual.
Can I ask you, Chris, about jokes? Because I'm not really a joke teller. I'm kind of a storyteller and maybe the odd quip. I don't know. But you are, I hope you don't mind me saying, and apologies for people listening for blowing a bit of smoke here, but when I've seen you, you make me properly laugh, right? So what I want to know is, where do those jokes come from? It's a bit like asking a magician for the secret to their tricks, I guess. But, you know, do you have a process? Do you have a room you go to? Do you go for a walk? Do you sit in front of a laptop? You know, where do those jokes come from? I'm fascinated to know.
It's a little bit of everything, to be honest. Sometimes it's sitting down in front of a computer and trying to write a bit, and sometimes it's when you're trying to go to sleep, and sometimes it's on stage. A lot of the jokes that work the best, you think of in the moment, and they just get a laugh out of a room, and you'll think, do you know what, I'll say that again. And sometimes they don't work ever again. But sometimes that's where the best stuff comes from.
In terms of where you are now, do you feel that your visual impairment is a disadvantage, an advantage, or neither here nor there for you now?
I would say it's a disadvantage in most situations. And you could argue it's an advantage because there are broadcasting quotas on inclusion and diversity and all that kind of stuff. But there's also a lot of people on TV that don't fall into diverse categories. You know, you hear them referred to as the kind of straight white male or whatever. Mm. And I've been doing stand-up for 19 years. And if I'd have been able to see, I think my experience on the circuit probably would have gave me a lot of these opportunities earlier. Maybe these pushes for diversity and inclusion have made some of the production companies and broadcasters give me an opportunity. And I've, you know, they've gone well and I've proven myself and I've kind of got extra opportunities and they've all gone well and blah, 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 blah. Suddenly I've got like, you know, 20 odd shows that we've done in the last year or and a half or whatever. But the flip side of that is if I hadn't have been blind, I think I probably would have got those earlier. I'm not really a fan of positive discrimination in terms of it's a balancing kind of tightrope, isn't it? In that you don't suddenly want to go, we need more blind people on the telly, because you need people who've got the experience.
And we just need to remove the barriers, don't we, really? That's more the issue. We don't want disabled people on for the sake of it.
You need to remove the barriers. You need to remove the barriers at grassroots levels, because there's no point in just putting disabled people on the TV in comedy, for example, that have only got 1 year's experience of comedy.
And they've got to be funny.
Yeah, because people will see them on the telly and go, oh, blind people aren't very funny, or disabled people aren't very funny, are they? Do you know what I mean? It's because there's nothing they can do about that. They haven't got the experience of 10 years trekking around the country doing gigs in all shapes and sizes of rooms.
Okay, we spent a lot of time being at least vaguely serious. Let's think about Christmas, because let's be honest, we're a couple of weeks before Christmas when we're recording this. And you have experience of trying to be jolly in July, don't you?
Well, I've recorded in 2019, I filmed the QI Christmas special in a blistering heatwave in August. it was so phenomenally hot that I arrived at the studio in shorts and a t-shirt, and then had to don me me thick woolly Christmas jumper to do the Christmas special. And we had to do a Guinness Book of Records how many Christmas jumpers. I ended up with five Christmas jumpers on top of each other. you know, trying to break a Guinness World Record in a 33 degree heat wave.
I call it Noddy Holder syndrome because, you know, he wrote his most famous hit in, was it July in New York, and it was absolutely scorching. Yeah.
They filmed Live at the Apollo in September. And what they do with Live at the Apollo, they film 6 episodes and a Christmas special, all in the same little batch. And so I did the Christmas special in 2019. But they go, if you've got any Christmas stuff or you can make it Christmassy, all the better. So I wrote some Christmas material, and I had to go out at the end of August and beginning of September in again a heat wave. People are out in shorts and T-shirts at comedy clubs, and I'm doing jokes about mince pies and Christmas dinners.
Obviously, you managed to think your way into it and get your head into that sort of Christmas space, I suppose.
Yeah, and the thing is, it gives you a false positive because people laugh at the ridiculousness of it. You have to tell them, I'm doing live with the Christmas special live at the Apollo next week, and I need to do some Christmas jokes. Can you give me 5 minutes to run through this? And then they all feel like they're part of something a little bit weird, and they laugh at things more than they maybe would do. And so you go away thinking, oh, all this stuff, all this Christmas stuff is brilliant. And it turns out that like half of it's rubbish. They were just laughing because you were a bloke in a heat wave doing Christmas jokes.
What does Christmas hold for you? What will you be doing on the big day?
We're just going to have a quiet one. So we're going to, me, my wife and my daughter at home, toys and a couple of films probably, you know. And actually, I will watch the Royal Variety. I filmed the Royal Variety performance this year. And that is on the 19th of December, which might have been on already by the time this goes out. But I suppose that will be one thing that I do watch live on the telly. And I'll just have to grin and bear myself for my 5 or 6 minute spot on that.
Are you the kind of dad who can put things together and repair toys and other things? Or, you know, if something goes wrong on Christmas Day, is it, sorry, you'll just have to wait until the shop's open? How would you cope with that?
I'll put the batteries in, mate. I'm a fiddler and a fidgeter. And also, you know, if I take something out of a box that comes in 5 parts, I will just fidget with it until I've got it together. And half the time, it'll mean I'll snap a bit off and it'll be unusable. So because of eyesight, I've never been a follower of instructions. So anything that does need assembling or putting together, it's best it's removed from my jurisdiction completely until somebody with eyesight has read the instructions and put it together properly before I break it, to be honest.
What does the future hold? What are your plans for next year then?
The tour starts beginning of April, and we've got 40 dates at the minute, which take us up to the end of June. And then we're going to have another 40-odd, 50 starting in September.
Look, it's been great to chat to you, and I hope you have a fabulous Christmas and an even more successful 2022. And as I say, thanks very much indeed for your time today, because I know you're busy. Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
So there you go. That's Chris McCausland. I hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as I enjoyed recording it and speaking to Chris. I found it really interesting. So before we go to the track I've chosen by The Vow, just wanted to wish everybody all the best for Christmas and the new year. It's been a difficult year for many people, I know, and hopefully we'll be through the hairpin bend onto straighter track within the next few weeks. So which track have I chosen by The Vow? I know this is the part of the podcast you all wait for. I've chosen one called Bluer Than You, not because Chris's comedy is in any way blue, but purely because I really like this track. This is Bluer Than You by The Vow.
I was happy on the day I met you. Then I jumped through the hoops that I'm still jumping through. You're written in the lines of my face. Don't the lines of my hands testify my fate? Then sorry, of course, is a death-defying word. The sticks and the stones have shattered my bones. Names have merely disemboweled me. But I won't be a slave from the crypt to the grave. I'm on my knees, the Lord to praise. In heart, in mind, in see when you've fallen from grace. When your heart is exposed and explodes in your face. And every time I open my eyes, I see wise men and fools pretending my demise. I was happy till the day I met you. Had a song in my heart and an aim to be true. Now I've got a thought to appease. There's no rest for my mind, no cure for my disease. It's the sticks and the stones that shatter your bones. Names can only disembowel you. But I won't be a slave from the crib to the grave. I'm on my knees, the Lord is praising. Shatter your bones. Names will only disembowel you. But I won't be a slave from the crib to the grave. I'm